This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 20th of July 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 263 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on this week's programme, as economies around the world continue on the road back to growth, the journalist Alex Brummer joins us to unpick the banking crisis, but also its lingering effects today.
Also ahead, Syrian artist Issam Korbaj will be here to discuss his latest exhibition that exhibits reclaimed objects to articulate the state of his nation in the past and today.
And before the end of the programme, we'll huddle around the piano and hear a new performance work that lets the pianos themselves do the talking.
All that and some new music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. If I had to design a new fragrance for the Monocle range of perfumes,
yes,
this week, do you know what it'd be called?
Sweat.
I'm feeling a bit torpor. Somehow this week. It's felt like a long week somehow. Not in a necessarily bad way. It's been kind of a nice vibe in the office. We're kind of doing stuff. It's kind of churning over, isn't it? But it feels a little bit slow. Maybe it's the weather, Andrew. It's been muggy here in London.
It's been very muggy. We've had ice cream afternoons, though.
We have. We've had affogato afternoons.
Yes.
Well, it's very forgettable.
We've had cornettos. We've had
Tom Reynolds,
lots of iced coffee.
Tom Reynolds, our new man with a plan, has been out buying the Classico Cornetto, strawberry, the Fragola Cornetto.
He's a man with kind of an inner child. He likes sweeties.
I don't think he eats anything else.
I think that's his main intake of calories.
I think he's seen the different flavours and thinks that's your five a day.
Now, have you ever seen a piano talk? We're going to see that later on.
I thought that was very...
The pianos are going to do the talking.
An alluring introduction to something.
This studio is not very big. If there's 20 of them coming in here to chat...
Maybe there'll be a little like a Bon Tempi organ. little tinkly one in the corner. Okay, demo button. That's what's going to happen.
We're looking forward to all of those things. But first, what should we do?
Why don't we drag him, haul him across the news coals? Tom Edwards is back.
And when he's not on holiday in the Bahamas, skiing down the slopes of the French Alps, or drinking martinis in Hawaii, he's here. It's Tom Edwards with the news look ahead.
Oh, yeah.
Should I stop playing the slide guitar now?
Keep going. I like it.
You're the only man, though, who goes to the Bahamas on holiday on a donkey, it seems.
I can do that. Clip-clop my way over there. That must make you feel very summery.
I love that. That's a really good theme tune for you.
I've got a few sort of summary selections for the days ahead. Would you like me to share them with
you? Start summarising.
Magic still there.
Yeah, it is.
We start in Paris. Paris Plage, the annual beaches. You know, do this. Urban beaches. The former mayor, Bertrand Delano, introduced this idea back more than 10 years ago now. It gives the Parisians the chance to go to the seaside. In the city. What do you think about that, Andrew? Do you like that idea? Should we import that?
Well, they did try and do it other places. I think they tried to do it on the Thames. Didn't work out very well.
It's a bit grim, isn't it?
It's a bit grim because it gets a bit dirty. Yeah,
it's quite a lot of flotsam and jetsam.
And it's not very nice getting back to the office with like sand in unusual places.
Imagine if you had some flotsam in an unusual place.
He was an interesting mayor for Paris. He kind of shook things up a bit. So good on him. Yeah, I don't mind Paris having it.
It's a bit of a fixture, and it's there right through to August.
And it's also a bit easier along the Seine, because you have those kind of like nice kind of like walks alongside the actual river that you can just cover sand. Whereas if you kind of went down onto the edge of the Thames, you might get splashed.
It can be
by a tour boat.
A bit grim. I think we should revisit it though here in London. Just one for them to think about. For Bojo to consider, perhaps. couple of other interesting things on Wednesday. Revolution Day in Egypt, always interesting. Obviously, quite a lot of tension simmering away. That's the big secular public holiday, of course, commemorates the revolution from the 50s when Nasser instigated this military coup. And I think it's always interesting to watch what happens there, because there's obviously a lot of complex feeling about military rule, free elections, and we've obviously been charting the progress over the last couple of years. And those kind of days, you'll see a lot of people on the streets, a lot of events. Will it be all well-mannered? Will there be tensions? Just one to keep an eye on. But there's lots of things happening on Wednesday. What about this? The Commonwealth Games begins in Glasgow.
They're the friendly games, aren't they?
The friendly games. Some might say, Rob, the pointless ones.
They're not that competitive ones.
Well, it's
Mo
a different
Farah's
one.
Not playing, is he?
Oh, no, they think he might not.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's touch and go.
Okay.
What about the
one-legged race?
That's
Sports Day.
Come on, poor old Mo. Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Egg and spoon. but is the Commonwealth, you know, the relevance of the Commonwealth is something that we sometimes touch upon, and the relevance, I guess, of its sporting marquee moment of the summer.
But the Commonwealth games are quite good because lots of the countries in the Commonwealth are pretty good, aren't they? I mean, we haven't got the US and Jamaica there. Have you got Jamaica? I don't even know.
Yeah, Jamaica. Yeah.
Jamaica. So you're right, yeah. Mm.
No, there's a lot of good, you know, so the athletics is usually pretty good. But they've slightly...
You don't have any Belarusian shot putters, but hey, that's not going to ruin...
It's not going to ruin your enjoyment.
I've got a widescreen TV.
but they've slightly shaken it up. So there's 71 competing nations. Andrew, can you name all 71 Commonwealth members?
Well, the fact is that some people have now joined the Commonwealth that were never part of the British Empire, haven't they? So some people have kind of like... dibbed in.
Well, they like it because it's so friendly. They like the ambience.
Yeah,
I think that's rather.
That's quite a lot. So I presume there's lots of little island nations among all.
Yeah,
those.
And there's often great stories where you'll have a kind of comedy single athlete who's in one discipline who's managed to get there to represent proudly flag carrying, maybe not the most naturally talented. There's 5,000 athletes taking part.
Did you ever go to Commonwealth House when it was up and running in London?
I did not.
It was a highlight of a school trip when I was young. Came up to London, and each country had their own little stand.
Yeah,
my favourite was really not a country. It was because there was a stand for British Antarctica, and it just had penguins on it. That was brilliant. Nice. Oh. Dead, stuffed, but they were good. Oh.
I was going to say, how did I miss out on that?
But were they like a diorama?
Yeah, it was like, but no, each, you know, there was like kind of like lots of kind of rattan skirts and things. It was a very
kind of
very colonial view, I think, of the Commonwealth. But it was
what's
good
to enjoy about that.
Yeah,
again, I could dust down my pith helmet and take that in.
Do we think in introducing national dress into the Commonwealth Games, you have to swim in a grass skirt, all that sort of thing?
I think that would just ratchet it up a few levels.
Yeah, really. Exactly.
Let's lobby to get that happening.
Yeah,
that's all starting on Wednesday. A couple of slightly lunatic events that are happening around the world. World Santa Congress.
Oh,
what in the height of summer?
Where's that?
They all get together in Bakken in Denmark. More than 100 Santas from around the world. Our younger listeners, don't worry, there's only really one. The Danish Santa Claus Guild are involved in the organisation. They have to do it during downtime Santa because he's pretty busy.
Yeah.
First time he is.
What's their summer attire, I wonder?
I think they have to wear their regular clothing and rely on
just hope it's cold.
There's also elves, naturally. And on their website, it says there'll also be pixies there. Are they involved in it? I don't know what they're doing there.
Pixies are headlining.
That's a bit like
musical entertainment.
It's a bit like the Commonwealth Games. They've kind of dibbed in as well. The
exactly.
Pixies want to join in. Christmas sounds fun.
Can the Pixies get involved? Yeah, get along with that. Another one, I thought this particularly for you, Rob, from next Friday.
particularly for you, Rob, is always worrying when someone says that.
It's the Austrian Lederhosen Festival.
Ooh.
I know, again, you're talking about pith helmet for me, leather trousers for you. It's a celebration of all traditional leather clothes.
What party are you two going to?
Near Salzburg at Windischgarten.
Yep.
There's Miss Lederhosen. She'll be revealed. Hopefully, partially clothed at least. And a prize given to the best dressed man. It's unclear whether he's also called Mr. or Herr Lederhosen, but he gets an award.
Best
as
dressed
well.
Man, and that is not. We'd like to just say that's not a contradiction in terms.
No, exactly.
A, it being in Austria, and B, it being the Lederhosen Championships.
Exactly. So, a few kind of esoteric summary events happening.
Right? I love that. That's really excellent. I like the sort of Lederhosen Championships, sort of precursor to the Oktoberfest.
Exactly. Just limber up a little.
Limber up. My friend Max in Geneva has bought a pair of Lederhosen because he had to keep on going to sort of actual events, which, I mean, he's a banker, it's quite serious stuff, but it seems he's either in a suit and tie or in Lederhosen, which he has to wear to go to actual some Swiss events. He has to wear it. So he's actually got his own Lederhosen.
That's
now,
good.
Because it was just like, I don't want to, who wants to hire a Lederhosen?
You don't want to hire it.
Imagine, it's hiring a jockstrap, isn't it?
And that's unsavoury. But also, it's very proprietary, you know, it's very important. There's particular nuances, different bits of appearance.
Yeah.
A friend of mine is from a particular part of Bavaria, and they wear the you know, the sock that's just around the calf section. You know,
Thomas Müller way of doing it.
One of them is just bare ankle and foot.
Yeah.
It's not really a... What is that even called? Is it just like the top part of the sock? Not really describing this very well. I'm doing gestures.
No, what you mean.
Not great on radio for our listeners. But yeah, and I was quite struck by those.
And there's been a proper revival in people wearing it. I think lots of young guys now own it because it's a kind of... partly because of the success of the Oktoberfest, but all of the kind of music that goes with it. You have these TV stations now that just play this kind of... You know, this traditional music that's oddly got a kind of following amongst young people. People like to go to the, you know, the beer festivals, and
it's like a return of these heritage items. I'm waiting for it to happen here in London, Andrew. I can legitimately wear my Pearly King suit. Yeah, it's there. It's
you've
ready.
You've got a Morris Dancing outfit.
Not Morris Dancing. I'm Pearly King. More.
Okay.
You know,
more Pearly King.
From the old East London, you know.
So I'm more country boy. I'm going for the Morris Dancing outfit.
Hey, you wear it. I'll wear mine.
Okay. Nice.
It's a deal. Good. What will you be attired in?
You two cats got a very crazy wardrobe going on there. Buttons and leather. Enjoy. Is that the last of your offerings?
Do you want more summer esoteric?
Give us a final one before.
Okay,
we go.
Well, let's come back close to home again. This is another one. I think, Rob, I don't know, you may even be going to this. Whitstable.
I'm going to the Oyster Festival.
The Oyster Festival.
Yes.
So that's from, I think, the following Saturday. It runs for about a week, and there's all sorts of things happening. There's an oyster eating contest. Once again, Rob, I ask you, will you be taking part?
I will certainly be covering this for the Culture Show on Monocle 24. Fact.
But I want you to do some competitive eating.
Okay, all right, yeah.
Give it a bash.
I can eat about 20 in one sitting, but I tell you what.
That's pretty good.
I get very horny and then I'm sick.
Friday Shea Brown. but yes, I mean, that's a real kind of
It's an amazing, and the whole point, and the centrepiece of this thing, it's a week-long festival, the centrepiece is this sort of blessing of the oysters ceremony, and it's a strange sort of pagan ritual where this sort of merman walks out the sea dragging this net of oysters, and he's blessed by some sort of quasi-pagan priest who's got a bowler hat, but otherwise, it's this amazing sort of oldie English thing, and I'm doing a sort of an English folk special of weird pagan stuff on the Culture Show, and that's going to be one of the things that was what I went swan upping to do. So.
I've got now swan. That's an event and a half.
That's
isn't
an
it?
Event and a half. Yeah. So this is good. Andrew's looking at me, going, "Why are you here? What are you doing on this radio station? Doing that?"
No, I like Whistball.
Whistball's nice.
Yeah, I've been down there for oysters, but I couldn't eat 20. I always feel it's a bit of a challenge eating an oyster. That's why I like Tabasco, and I'm sure because it's kind of covering up the fact that I'm eating something that's alive.
the sounds of Whitstable brought to you on the Monocle Weekly. There we are. That's the next week.
Nice.
It's a week to look forward to.
Now, the banking crisis of 2007 is still the source of economic hardship and political uncertainty in economies around the world. But things, we're told, are improving. From falling unemployment rates to rising GDPs, the path to prosperity may feel a little less arduous than it did a few short years ago.
Well, in a new book, the award-winning financial journalist Alex Brummer claims that despite wide-ranging banking reforms and rafts of fresh regulation aimed at avoiding similar crises in the future, the culture of banking around the world has, in reality, changed little, and the risks of future economic instability remain high. Well, I'm delighted to say that Alex Brummer, the author of Bad Banks, Greed, Incompetence, and the Next Global Crisis, joins us now. Perhaps we should start almost at the end of your book then, before jumping back to some of the characters that kicked it all off in the first place. But your feeling is that despite this kind of sense, as we said in the introduction there, that the economies around the world are kind of getting back to somewhere near health, that there remains inherent risks. And you seem to point in the book to an unwillingness really on the banks to go for deep-seated reform.
I think that the culture inside the banks has not really changed, that even though they were at the core of the initial crisis, the crisis in 2007-2009, they were right at the centre of it. It was their behaviour which brought about this great financial crash. That in parts of the world, I mean Europe in particular, the reforms just haven't taken place. Here in London, we are learning every day of new bad practices by the banks. I think it was only yesterday that Lloyds Bank actually admitted that it had been sending out for 10 years solicitors' letters or alleged solicitors' letters trying to collect debts, which were actually fabricated on a sort of John Ball printing set in their own offices. So that kind of behaviour still seems endemic, and it's very hard to squeeze it out.
I know that when you come to the conclusions of your book, you talk about everything about, you know, is there a need to change the culture of banks, and does that include having more women on boards, for example? What are some of the ideas that you think would begin to change the culture inside banks and make them realise that they're servants as well as, you know, the people gathering profits for their shareholders?
I've always felt that, you know, and I've said this in my earlier book on the Northern Rock crisis, right at the beginning of this affair, this book picks up after those initial crises, that I always thought the bonus culture, the way that bankers pay themselves, is right at the heart of what is wrong. Because all the incentives are wrong. The incentives are to make short-term profits, but banking ought to be a long-term business. It ought to be about providing businesses and ordinary people with loans and safe place to keep their money. And I think that utility banking notion was lost in this kind of flurry of investment banking and trading on markets. None of us really understand the interest rate market, the foreign exchange market, the gold market, the energy market. In all of those markets, we've seen, even since the financial crisis, indeed in the last year or two, bad behavior reasserting itself. And it's because the incentives are all wrong that the bankers feel they deserve these bonuses. If they can get them over the short term, the profit motive is so strong that real banking, long-term utility banking, takes second place.
And Alex, your book's called Bad Banks. Could it have been called Bad Bankers? Who are some of the personalities involved?
Well, the reason I called it Bad Banks, just to say, it has a double meaning. In technical financial terms, a bad bank is a bank where you stick all your rotten debt.
Right.
But you know, if you go through the book, many of the names will be recognised. I've talked to all of them in the process of writing the book. So except for Fred Goodwin, I didn't talk to him in the process of writing the book. I knew him before the book was written. So my recollections of him are historic in the sense that he did not cooperate with the book. But Bob Diamond, for instance, at Barclays Bank, who's one of the most, I think, a very charming, likeable fellow. But when he ran Barclays Bank, which he did, he was chief executive and he was president of the investment banking arm. When he ran Barclays Bank, you know, he ran it like a Porsche in a 100-mile-an-hour zone going at 220 miles an hour down the motorway. He ran it for profits. He drove the profits until the profits of the investment bank were, Barclays had been around for over 200 years, but the profits of the investment bank became more important than the profits of the ordinary bank. And so it was kind of cart driving the horse. Absolutely delightful fellow. You'd really enjoy his company if he was in this room now. But his motivations were to make as much money as quickly as possible, both for himself, for his colleagues, and for the bank. But I think those are the wrong motivations in what we want in a banking system.
Just picking up on what Rob said, I guess that's the kind of the interesting balancing act that you play in the book. You know, that there were, of course, you know, the macroeconomic things going on. You know, there were the consequences of 9/11, for example, and how that kind of changed the attitude towards investment and fear within the markets. But you do come back to these one or two characters, certainly when we look at a bank like RBS here in the UK. And this, there seemed to be a kind of a belief that every bank could be a big bank and that everyone was trying to buy up everything. There was a spending spree going on that seemed to have no grip on reality.
Well, it's extraordinary. I find it extraordinary. We're 6 years since Gordon Brown did that emergency rescue of the banks in the autumn of 2008. Dramatic event. And you know, the Royal Bank of Scotland was at the core of that. And we still, 6 years on, the taxpayer still own 80% of the Royal Bank of Scotland. Why is that? It's because, as you say, Sir Fred Goodwin, or as he was then, he's now Fred Goodwin, he's lost his title, was engaged in some sort of macho game. He didn't like the idea that anybody else, any other bank in the world, was going to be bigger than his own bank. And indeed, he was driven into that last big deal that he did, which was to take over the Dutch bank ABN AMRO, which was the biggest takeover they'd ever done. He was driven into it because Barclays were going to do a friendly merger with them. And he couldn't stand the idea that Barclays were going to be bigger than RBS. So he was driven by some sort of macho culture. That's one of the reasons that some people say, well, maybe one of the things you need to do is calm down that kind of testosterone-driven banking and bring some more women into the picture. And indeed, you know, I think one of the best-run banks in the UK at the moment is Santander, and it is run by a woman.
I wanted to... We've talked about some of the personalities and some of the sort of hubris maybe here, Alex. That seems to be part of it. Banking seems to be something that should be based on systems and mathematics and things that are surefire hits in a way. And when egomania kind of gets involved in that, that presumably is when it goes wrong, when it becomes a top-down thing rather than a series of systems, right?
It's interesting you should talk about mathematics, because obviously that's a key part of banking, but actually it's also partly of what went wrong, that we developed a whole lot of complex financial instruments which had nothing to do with what I call traditional utility banking. I mean, it's actually a very simple process. I mean, it's been going on since, you know, time immemorial, that, you know, that people give somebody money, they hope they look after that money, and those people lend it on to somebody else. And I think, you know, we're developing now an interesting area. Some people call it shadow banking, I call it disintermediation. It's a whole series of new institutions which try and reconnect ordinary people to the banking system. It's called peer-to-peer lending and so on. And I think that that, in a sense, if we fast forwarded 20 years, I think we'll see a very different looking financial system with much more speciality banks doing different types of things. And hopefully, and I mean, Sir Mervyn King, he's now Lord King, the former governor of the Bank of England. I mean, he always made the case that it didn't make any sense for these kind of gambling banks, the casino banks, to be part of the ordinary banks which lend to ordinary people and ordinary businesses. And, you know, that lending to ordinary businesses is critical. For small businesses to expand, they need capital. They need to be able to take on new employees. They need to be able to buy new premises, need to be able to buy new calculating machines or whatever else they need. And in order to do that, they've got to be able to borrow. And banks lost that.
As a bank, which brand? I mean, we think about Barclays as a 200-year-old bank. It was on every high street in the UK. And then it became this kind of monstrous profit organ of gambling. Which brand was the sort of most hurt, you think, amongst those banks? You mentioned Santander, which obviously is originally a Spanish bank.
It was,
but
yes.
But which ones sort of come off worst in terms of maybe having public trust?
Obviously, that, you know, even the Royal Bank of Scotland might be considered the safest bank because it has the government standing behind it. I think it turned out to be the rottenest bank. It's even now burdened with enormous amount of bad debts left from lending it did during the crisis. You know, it's having enormous trouble cleaning itself up. I mean, it's a real problem. That doesn't mean it's not safe to bank at RBS. I mean, it's perfectly safe. In fact, as I say, it may be the safest place, you know, government standing behind it. But by now, if you look at what's happened in the United States, you know, the United States government did roughly the same as the British government, except it did it much faster and much more deeply. It made every big bank, all the money center banks, take government money, government capital. But it put in more than they needed, and they came out much more quickly. And they then were able to start re-lending again. And I think we kind of botched it a bit. We were a bit bureaucratic about how we did it. We set up this thing, intermediary between the banks and the government and UK financial investments, and it hasn't worked terribly well.
Alex, can I ask you almost a political question? You work for a newspaper that's been great at covering this, and you've certainly been at the forefront of covering this. It's the Daily Mail, which is, yep, you know, obviously slightly to the right of politics. Now, the Daily Mail, in many cases, is arguing for light government touch, less intervention of legislation, less paperwork, all those things. It's obviously, it likes what Thatcher did in many ways to the UK, but much of this, even in your book, it seems to stem from the time of the Big Bang. And you go back to the days prior to that when actually bankers didn't earn much more than other kind of people with, you know, who had professional careers. Is there, you know, philosophically for you, is there a little bit of a something to be worked out about why the banks are to be treated in a slightly different way? Because when I see, you know, Boris Johnson, for example, he says, leave the banks alone. Or, you know, yep, even people in David Cameron's government here seem to be unsure about the relationship almost.
I think that, you know, that I would be a great supporter of, you know, laissez-faire, free markets, the Thatcher reforms. But I think, you know, that requires people to take on responsibility for what they're doing. We thought banks were going to behave in a responsible fashion. We thought the financial system would behave in a responsible fashion. It did deliver a golden goose for Britain in the sense that, you know, in the Labour years, the tax generated by the banks through their high earnings, through the bonuses and all the rest of it, actually paid for a lot of the expansion of the National Health Service, new hospitals, better schools and so on. So it did actually produce a kind of dividend. But in producing that dividend, we took our eye off the ball. What I think is a big mistake is that we've had this terrible crisis and we've had what I would say is terribly piecemeal reform. That the reform has come in a stuttered way, and that's largely because of politics. The Brown administration did not want, when it was still in power up until 2010, did not want to acknowledge that it had allowed this climate of free-for-all to foster in a very dangerous way, and so it didn't want to investigate itself. And the Conservatives which followed didn't want to be seen as over-regulating and interfering in free markets. So we've had this kind of cultural, this kind of political vacuum around this area, and it's left to independent regulators, which you've now set up, to try and get some grip on that and try and find a balance. But the finding that balance is very, very tricky. And I think, you know, the public has had a great disservice. There should have been you know, we've had inquiries into the press, favourite subject of the Daily Mail. We've had endless inquiries into very important matters of historic child abuse and so on. But this thing, which caused enormous poverty in Britain, around the world, great social disruption. You know, we're still in the crisis in Europe. You know, 70% young people unemployed in Greece. I mean, this is disastrous. And there's been no comprehensive in Europe or in Britain inquiry into what went wrong in the banking system. And I think that's a big lacuna in the whole thing.
And that is presumably the thing. That presumably also is the job of an editor like you, whether or this is the author of a book or is one of the editors of a big national newspaper, to find a human story that excites us and interests us about those other two sort of scandals, right?
It is, really. It's, you know, I've tried to draw out in the book one or two small case studies and one or two of the things which really hurt. And I think, you know, I'm particularly personally disturbed by what's happened in Europe, not because I'm a Europhobe. In fact, you know, probably much more neutral than my paper is on the subject of Europe. But I do think that the lack of responsibility which Brussels has taken and Berlin and Frankfurt have taken for repairing the banking system in Europe has had disastrous consequences for a lot of ordinary people, because banks are the lifeblood of the economy. You know, people can't get credit. If companies can't get credit, if small businesses can't get credit, they're crushed. I'm afraid that that's what's happened.
Well, I'm glad you didn't come in here at 200 miles an hour in your Porsche and 100 mile an hour limit. I love the idea of a 100 mile an hour limit in London. This must be in the banking lane. The author of Bad Banks, Greed, Incompetence and the Next Global Crisis, Alex Brummer. Thank you very much for joining us on The Weekly. It's time for some new music here on the Monocle Weekly. This is new. It's a summer song. This is singer-songwriter B.T. Wolfe with Wish.
I wish we woke up gladly every single day to count our many blessings, the ones we never say. I wish we had the power to hold on to our truth. In the darkest hour, it would still shine through. I wish I never longed for the home I left behind. I wish my only focus was the chapter at the time. I wish I could be stronger when I had to let you down. I wish I could hold on to times I made you proud. I wish
was Wish, new from B.T. Wolfe.
Enjoy listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound. Up next, meet with Syrian artist Issam Kurabaj on his latest exhibition, Unearthed. Stay with us.
A nation defining its identity or architectural vandalism, Monocle Films heads to the capital of the Republic of Macedonia to investigate a controversial building project.
Museums, theatres and government ministries have sprouted up along the riverbank, and with their neoclassical and Baroque stylings, the Skopje 2014 building boom harks back to the past. It's nothing less than eyebrow-raising, and for some, it's positively stomach-churning.
Skopje 2014, an architectural facelift, now playing in the Films menu on Monocle.com.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound. Now, the peaceful protests that swept through towns and cities across Syria in 2011 couldn't feel more removed from the chaos and the bloodshed that dominate life in the country today. And for those Syrians who have long lived overseas, the task of articulating the ongoing war in the country they call home is often a fraught and painful process.
Well, the artist Issam Korbaj, who's lived in Cambridge in the UK since 1990, has long depicted the disintegration of societies in the Middle East, from an interpretation of the Epic of Gilgamesh to the 2003 US-led invasion of Iraq. But the war in his native Syria has created an uneasy boundary between the current reality in the country and his own creative process. And I'm delighted to say that Issam joins us in the studio now. Issam, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. I wanted to ask you first, being a Syrian artist, obviously you've always been a Syrian artist, but it means something different to everybody right now, doesn't it? Does that help put your show in perspective, or does it maybe make it a little bit more difficult to talk about?
Very, very interesting question, actually. This is part of the struggle, because I never thought that is I will leave Syria and Syria becomes the subject of my own work. I thought I am turning the page and I'm living somewhere else. I thought that it is over, but by the look of it, it is the roots of my own personality as well as my own work. And what's happening now in Syria, it is, I cannot escape but actually deal with it in a visual form.
Issam, looking at the works that are in the exhibition, when you first look at them, you think they may be found objects, probably from Syria. You think that they're probably purely documentary in a way. Mm. But actually, when you begin to read the descriptions and understand, so for example, there's a crushed child's bicycle. But in fact, you found the crushed bicycle in Cambridge, where you work. You know, there are broken chairs with Arabic script on, but they're not from Syria. So what's interesting for me when you look at these pieces, they're very evocative of something, but it's important that the viewer understands that you're an artist. You're not a gatherer of found objects. Could you explain to us how that works?
It is very important for me as an artist that if somebody is visiting my work or looking at my work, that is, they don't have only one message from me. I like the idea there is multiple messages. And somewhere it's very subtle, somewhere it's very blunt. And particularly the two pieces you mentioned, they are very blunt. So interesting that you picked up on these. That is the first one, which is the tricycle.
I'm obviously a slightly blunt character, but I guess.
So the idea that is of this tricycle, it started in 2003, at the time of the Iraqi invasion or invasion of Iraq. And I felt that I needed to do something with libraries and with children. So this is the two things that is I started working with, a project called Palimpsest. So my child was, if you like, not using anymore his tricycle. So I thought this is a very interesting object to play with. Originally a found object, but by squashing it, flattening it, it becomes a two-dimensional object. It's actually suddenly becomes very evocative piece and has multi-layers and has multi-meaning. So I thought that is, I will use this as the starting point of this exhibition, although it is produced in 2003. I am actually a gatherer of found objects. You are absolutely right. I do find lots of objects, and I do like to repurpose them.
But not necessarily from the battlefields of Syria, for example.
No.
You know, it's something you found in a skip in Cambridge.
Absolutely.
Can be just as useful for telling a story from Syria.
Absolutely. So this is very, very much exactly what you are saying. That is, the visitor to my exhibition will read more than what's happening in Syria. it is about Syria, but you might enter and go and just look at it as purely as aesthetic experience.
Before I hand back to Robert, what's funny about the tricycle piece is, you know, that you immediately add meaning to it. You imagine this child's life, but it's the wrong child in a way. It is a piece of art. Mm. And the strange other thing is the way that you've hung it this time, it almost looks like a body, or it looks almost flesh-like the way you've hung it.
Absolutely. Very, very well spotted. And the way how it is actually introduced this time in comparison with the previous exhibition which I had in my studio in Cambridge, it was a floor piece. By bringing the child in to become a grown-up now hanging on the wall, it's almost like the piece is living a new meaning by being produced in 2003 but exhibited in 2014 in a different context.
And maybe you can tell us, I know the show, your new show here in London, is called Unearthed. Mm. And reading around the subject, reading some of the stuff that you've said about this show and about other shows, you mentioned where you grew up in Syria. Mm. And you grew up in a house made of earth, you said. Mm. Is this a link? Because I like the fact that you're a tricky operator, Issam. I like the fact that we think your things are one thing, but they turn out to be something else. Maybe you can tell us about the naming of some of the pieces and of the show itself.
Lovely, very nice. Actually, the word unearthed, it came about because I work with the archaeologist in Cambridge, and this is part of my interest as an artist. That is, once I was sitting nearby a therapist and I asked by accident, "Are you an archaeologist?" And he said, "Yes, archaeologist of the self." And I thought, really very beautiful way of describing somebody being a psychologist. And I thought that is my work, or generally speaking, most of my projects relate to archaeology, from the word palimpsest to the word, my last project, excavating the present. So the word archaeology is present in my work. Now, the way how this particular project came about, that I thought I would like to exhibit these found objects in a gallery and with in reference to Syria. But you are absolutely right that in my childhood, my house was built with volcanic stones, but the roof was built with earth, if you like. And I thought the parallel in my statement about the exhibition, I draw this subtle parallel between the title of the project and the title or reference to my childhood, because it is very much homes and being destroyed. I felt that there must be something that is I need to draw to my childhood, and in comparing it with current people's children and childhood and position.
And in that, you've mentioned that the names of certain works of yours and whole shows of yours before have riffed on this idea of archaeology and of digging down. I mean, that's digging down and finding things that already exist, learning about something that happened before by what is happening now, or the way we're looking at things now. Is that what you want to do? I mean, in the wider context of what's happening politically now and in terms of the war there, is that something that is a helpful camera through which to look, if you know what I mean? Or does that cloud people's eyes, do you think?
I am definitely not trying to force this issue. I am an artist in the first place. I am not a politician. I'm not a journalist. I am making my statement, visual statement. Whatever is taken out of this visual statement, I am happy with. I have seen many interesting in the private view, somebody who was interested in textile. And I could see she was relating purely as a tactile experience. Yeah. And she wanted really to ask me to touch every single piece. And I said, fine. And I am not making a poster. I am not making, look, this is Syria, this is the tragedy. If this is what you are in tune to see, it's fine. If you are in tune to see purely abstract forms and abstract marks, equally fine for me.
Issam, you sit in Cambridge doing your work, and you're an artist in residence, I believe, at one of the colleges.
Yeah.
When we think of artists working, Cambridge doesn't always kind of strike you as the top of the list, but you talked about archaeology and some of your crossover with perhaps the academic world. Mm. Is this why you find it a good place to nurture your work?
There is actually quite a very interesting Cambridge as a first glimpse from outside. It's a very beautiful, small city. But the more you live, the more you dig the layers of the city, and you see it's
not just people painting pictures of punts and
no at all. Actually, there is fascinating group of people that is one could work with, from composers to mathematicians to scientists. I found it's a very nurturing environment for me as an artist to work with a scientist or to work with a composer. So this environment, actually, partly the environment, partly the scale of it. I come from a very small place. I like the idea of cycling. I like the idea of walking in the street and saying hello to people. And I found that this is the scale of the city. It's almost my memory of it. The first thing I have seen it, it's almost a beautiful hug. I was living in St. Petersburg in Russia, and the scale of that city coming to Cambridge, it looks like a theater set. It's not a city. It has this kind of toy-like quality about it. But definitely, maybe from your perspective from London, Cambridge looks completely different to my perspective, the one I was coming from St. Petersburg to Cambridge, and Cambridge seemed a very hospitable place. Without saying that there is quite a lot of difficulty.
Yeah, I understand that. Maybe it's hospitality rather when you're trying to make work about, you know, what's happening in Syria. Obviously it isn't a huge jump for you to think of both things at the same time. Mm. But somehow I think that sometimes when you have a kind of bucolic scene outside the window, for some artists they find that difficult to then tap into kind of darker, more difficult themes. But it's obviously one that inspires you.
I see exactly what you are saying, and I must say that is for the last exhibitions, actually, they were all relating to what's happening in Syria. Previously, no, I had lots of work relating to archaeology, relating to mathematics, and to Darwin, for example, to Newton. I worked with many different of these projects, but the political, if you like, project were in 2003, with Palimpsest, and with recently with the last three projects, one called Excavating the Present, one called Scattered Gathered, and this particular one which is Unearthed.
Well, they all sound like fascinating shows. Unearthed is on right now in London. Issam, thank you very much for joining us on The Weekly.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And you can catch Issam's latest exhibition, Unearthed, at the P21 Gallery here in London until August the 16th. Coming up here next on the Monocle Weekly, we'll tell you the tales of 20 interesting pianos.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
A new project here in London has tasked the musician Matthew Herbert with telling the tales of 20 pianos and unpicking the histories they were privy to. From a piano in a school assembly hall, the piano once played by Johann Christian Bach, to a piano that once spent its days behind bars in a British prison, to the most expensive piano ever made, the project is a fascinating insight into these musical witnesses to our lives and times. And I'm delighted to say that Ed McEwen of the Third Ear Listening Project, which devised and commissioned the work, joins us on the Monocle Weekly. Welcome to the show, Ed.
Thanks very much, Rob.
Thanks for coming in. I love the idea of this. Let's start with getting these things into the space in which they're going to be played, maybe lots of different spaces. Where did the idea come from, and where have the pianos come from?
The idea actually came from Matthew himself. It's been something they've been thinking about, and I think one of the things that might have appealed to him, being a composer who works with samples and puts them on a keyboard, is creating an instrument which is a meta instrument, because it's a piano of pianos. So there's a kind of conceit, because he got, as being director of the new radiophonic workshop, he got a colleague of his, Jan Sesnek, in Edinburgh, to make a specially devised keyboard, which is actually, it's built into a piano. So it's a bit like a conceit. So there's an ordinary guy sitting at an ordinary table, tinkling away, and actually what he's being able to control, because he's got a foot pedal that can scroll between the recordings of the 20 different pianos, and actually slightly more than that, which I'm sure we'll come on to, that he's being able to play not just one piano, but actually a piano of pianos. So there's a kind of
so
nice
he's playing the
that.
So in a way, so this new instrument, this kind of crazy amalgamation of different instruments, it's sampling the sounds of different pianos, and you can make different noises with that end piano.
I was just thinking about this earlier because it's basically a different form of interface rather than a QWERTY keyboard. It's got a whole set of samples already in a database, and they're just being played by the keys of a piano in the same way that you might do an ordinary instrument. But normally you might have, I know, if you think of one of Matthew's other projects, you could have a squealing pig in there.
You know, yeah, I was going to ask you, I think we had him to talk about the pig project.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So you could have whatever sound you want. It could be the sounds in the studio. It could be the sounds of dogs barking outside, whatever it happens to be. If you've got a keyboard sound, generally it's relatively artificial, or it's an imitation of a real piano. Actually, what we've got here are the recordings of 20 actual pianos, but more than that, because he's also superimposed a number of those the sounds of one piano onto the sounds of another piano to make something which is. I was really shocked when I first heard it, and it was brilliant because you never know quite what you're going to get when you're commissioning, and sometimes you can be surprised, and sometimes you can be disappointed. But this was. I'd just not expected it at all. I knew all about what he was doing, but I just didn't know what to expect. And it was great.
And let's discuss some of the individual pianos themselves. There's a big classical vibe, unsurprisingly. There's Johann Christian Bach's piano, which we mentioned in the introduction. I think Mahler's piano is in there. Various different Rachmaninoff's touring piano, I think, is in there. These must be, I mean, for a musician like Matthew as well, these must be nice artifacts to touch and investigate. Or does he treat all these imposters just the same? Like, I know one of your things is like a piano that's been taken from a school assembly hall.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he treats them very much in the same way. In fact, he was disinclined towards musicians' instruments as at least prioritising them.
Yeah.
One of the things that we suggested is that because we're taking this project on tour, it's going around lots of different places, and because we're interested in a wide range of pianos and just the process of producing the finding of the recording, documenting, and then being able to create the instrument with these recordings of the different pianos was going to be a bit of a nightmare if we wanted to try and get a real diversity of it. So what we did is parceled out to all of the venue partners that we're working with, or festival partners, to find a piano in their area. So each time it goes to a given location, they kind of wave the flag of the particular piano from their area. And so they did a bit of a hunt around. Some of them did a social media thing. Some of them just asked questions of, I don't know, piano tuners in the area, those kinds of things, to get an idea of what pianos were around. So we got some that Matthew had already identified early on and thought, that piano we really want. Others which partners found, and some which came from contact with a number of instrument collections. And those instrument collections tended to be the ones where the composer's pianos came. The pianos, I think many of the more interesting pianos, were the ones who came from partners who'd kind of dug around and just found different kinds of stories. I mean, the one at Shoreditch Church is one of the best ones, partly because it's told beautifully as well. Only some of the performances when it's going round will have recordings of the stories themselves, although all the stories are available
and
online.
How will that work? Is that an audio? Is that someone reading out a story, or how does that work?
Not exactly.
I didn't think it was going to be very simple, Ed, either.
So, okay, part of the brief was that the work had to be no more than 15 minutes, because it's part of the New Music Biennial, which is a process of commissioning 20 different pieces of music from across the different genres as a way of drawing attention to the range of work that's being made in Britain today. And because the showcase for these is going to be, one was at South Bank Centre a few weeks ago, the other one is in Glasgow at the opening weekend of the Commonwealth Games, these are being all presented within a given format. And the structure of the format is 15 minutes, talk about it, play it again, and then you move on. So each one has got an hour within the space in which it's going to be happening. So this created a slight dilemma for us, because most places that you go on tour to, you don't really want a 15-minute piece for the kind of thing that Matthew does, because what are you going to put alongside it? So in discussion with Matthew, we brought on board Sarah Nichols, and she has basically composed or made a whole set of response pieces to the stories. So we've got the stories summarised in a kind of little booklet, which is available online through Issue. There's a link to it through the Third Ear website. Mm-hmm. But the oral recordings, she's used and incorporated in pieces that she is performing when we're doing as an evening event.
And is there, would you get a sense that one is a Shoreditch Church's piano, one is a school assembly hall piano, one is some epic Steinway that's exceptionally expensive? Do you get a sense from that, from the pieces? Can you tell what you're listening to from the music?
From what Sarah does in her pieces, she's got more time to do it. He's got 20 pianos to get through within a 15-minute piece, ostensibly.
Yeah.
But he does a really neat thing at the beginning. Well, two neat things, really. One is he sets it up through an audio recording, which is, if you like, a set of instructions which are made known to the audience. But he also then, when the music starts, it starts with one note from each instrument, middle C, which is slightly pitched differently in some of the instruments, which are either slightly out of tune or tuned differently. You get a sense of the different sound qualities of the instruments, and you also get something of the texture of the space. He became really interested that the recordings captured not only the sound of the piano, but the sound of the room that the piano was in. And because he's interested in not just in the instrument as a mechanical beast that creates this particular type of sound,
but it's something that... in its environment, I guess.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and it's and people are going to want to work out what happens at the end of this. What happens at the end of all this? I know you're touring, you mentioned Essen. You're taking it around the world or around Europe. After it's been played at different festivals, where will it end up for people to be able to listen to it and maybe see it?
Okay, so it's going to be broadcast on BBC Radio 3 in August. I don't have a broadcast date, but it'll be there. It'll also be available for download through NMC Records. So that should be, again, available from kind of middle end of August, something like that.
And I know that you work for an organisation, Third Ear Listening, that does not lots of things like this, but it's a way of reinterpreting how people listen and, I guess, react to and behave around music. Is this sort of typical of what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really interested in context.
It's very untypical, and therefore it's typical of what you do. I like that.
Yeah, I think we listen with ideas in that sense. So you don't come to something with no expectation whatsoever. You come, if you go, whatever performance you go to, even if you're kind of a purebred, you go to this particular type of, chamber music at the Wigmore Hall, or whether you go to something skanky somewhere else, or whether you're particularly interested in party music, you go to it with... You'll hear the music, but I think at the same time as you hear the music, you hear it through the lens or the filter of all of the ideas that go into making that music what it is. And what my interest is in trying to make some of those ideas apparent, because they're often invisible to us. You don't necessarily realise that the baggage or the weight that comes with a lot of the music that you're going to. But trying to make that apparent and trying to make it fun at the same time, so that it's not simply a deconstruction of it, but it's a way of opening it up to be something other than what you thought it was in the first place, and make that funny.
Ed McEwen from the Third Ear Listening Project, which are bossing this 20 Pianos project at the moment. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for the invitation.
There we have it.
Well, that's all we have for this edition of 263. What does that mean, 263? 263, I imagine, of the Monocle Weekly. It was a good one. We discovered that pianos really can talk. They can.
Can I just like to point this into the fact that we were both meant to introduce that item, but due to the fact you couldn't stop laughing, I had to do it on my own. a little bit of daylight in upon the magic of the Monocle Weekly there, Andrew.
Well, it's normally your fault. You start laughing at something random, and then I lose it. Now you see you lost your pen as well. But it was a very nice show indeed. And I thought what was good also is I liked Alex Brummer a great deal. It's good when someone talk about finance and talk about it in a way that everybody kind of gets. It doesn't.
I liked him as well. He's a good talker.
Yes.
He was good. He was a good chap. What are we doing next week? Who knows? We'll probably be here, won't we, Andrew, will we?
I'm definitely here. I'm going nowhere.
Okay. In that case, me neither. Or me too, should I say.
It's just whether you can find me with my new camouflage socks, which you liked.
I really like your camouflage socks this week. Yeah.
Very difficult to spot me in the office when I'm wearing them.
It's just basically, mate, let's put an image in people's mind of you only wearing socks in the office.
Camouflage ones, so it doesn't matter. Can't find me.
Today's show, let's thank those people.
Yes, let's. I'll thank Claire Urban, who is our studio manager today.
And I'll thank Thomas Lewis, who produced Monocle Weekly today.
And he found the talking pianos.
He found them. We'll be here same time, same place next week. For the time being, from me, Robert Pound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.